This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sevisodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, we have a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist who we've had on the show just for once about 3 years ago. And it's an honor to have him back because he's such a busy man. Welcome to the show, Dr. Raman Subramaniam. It's wonderful to have you back. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, and great to be back.
Yes. We talk about the foundations of our health. We always talk about how it was built in our mother's wombs. A healthy pregnancy is much more than nourishing the growing fetus because the mother's metabolic condition is also very critical. We read tons of articles about how the environment is affecting the fetus, how a mother's health is affecting the fetus, obesity, malnourishment, all smoking, your diet, everything affects the growing fetus. So Dr. Raman's in the studio with us to help us understand this whole nurturing a healthy pregnancy from start to end. If you have a question for him, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Dr. Raman, let's just start. I mean, you've been practicing for a very long time now, and I know you look at high-risk pregnancies in particular at the moment.
That's correct.
What changes have you seen, whether positive or not? What have you noticed or have you observed over the years as far as Malaysian pregnancies are concerned?
Yes, that's a very good question because it's very relevant. The demographics has changed. The two main factors, one is, of course, women are getting pregnant at a later age and they are getting pregnant with in vitro fetal fertilization or assisted reproduction techniques.
IVF.
Mm-hmm. And the second thing is the expectations of the patients have differed over the last 30 to 40 years. Those days, there was no internet, no access to information. It was just hand-me-downs. But nowadays, with many sources of social media and access to the internet and people doing all sorts of searches in areas which are not evidence-based and personalized-based, you get all sorts of opinions, and then we get this whole lot of women who have decided how they wish to have their pregnancies monitored, managed, what they think should be done. And some of them are actually looking for doctors who will agree with them. So besides that, of course, is the fact that the number of pregnancies have actually dropped, fertility has dropped, and they are getting pregnant at a later age. So okay, that carries a lot of risks.
Sure. Let's go through one by one. It's very interesting. We know that people are, having babies later on in life. Malaysian women are delaying their first pregnancies. And what is the downside to that? We know that, the older we are, it is times against us. We all know that now. But in your experience, physiologically, how is a pregnancy different for a 25-year-old as opposed to a 35-year-old?
The first thing is the fertility declines with age. And you can look at the data that has come out from the IVF centers looking at the genetics of the egg, for example. You can see that after 33 to 35, the number of normal eggs decline. They actually are very little. And this leads to all the genetic diseases like Down syndrome and all that increase with age. And also the number of normal eggs decrease and the number of eggs produced decrease. So fertility takes a dive. Not putting into fact that there's also male infertility, which is also rising. So we always must not forget that male fertility is also rising, even in Malaysia. There's been data which has been published from UKM showing that sperm counts of men in the last 10 years has got worse. All this is due to stress, the type of food, the environment, the non-communicable diseases like hypertension, diabetes, and the lifestyle. So all this has contributed a lot. And of course, women are marrying later, partly because they are smarter, they are lot more going to universities, they attain a higher level and want to go higher, and by the time they've achieved what they want to achieve, they look back, they're already 40. And then they decide, I want to have a family. So that these are the contributing factors.
So reality is the quality of your eggs are actually dropping.
Yes.
From the age of 33 or so.
33, 35. By the time you reach 42, if you look at data that's published, about 80% of the eggs are abnormal. But the peak of fertility is somewhere around 22 to 25.
Okay.
That's about the peak.
But that would be the best age.
That would be a good age. So there's a lot to be said for the parents of the older years who used to say, hey, you're in the 20s, hurry up and get married. So I think that's... there's a lot to be said for
okay.
that.
But that's not happening.
That's not happening.
So we know it's
not happening.
It's happening
less and less.
Yes. So reality is most of us are getting married later. So what's a way forward? Freezing our eggs?
Oh, there are several techniques that are available. Yes, one of them is, you know, you can freeze it. But again, how long can you freeze it? That's the other thing. There are a lot of advancements in freezing techniques. There are even unripe eggs, which has been pioneered, I think, from Canada.
Yes.
Where they have actually cultured the eggs and so on. And the latest thing to add to all this is uterine transplantation.
What is that?
Where you actually transplant the uterus into a person. That
wow.
is like a kidney transplant. And there are about 9 pregnancies in the world now, ongoing pregnancies. They have had about 10 or 11 after uterine transplants. So that's the latest thing that has come out the last 3 years. And this is actually from the Swedish group.
Mm-hmm. But what are your thoughts on this? I mean, looking at all this technology and all these new techniques coming out, and for somebody who's practiced for such a long time, very much the traditional way, I mean, what are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, I think there's... Although I've practiced for a long time, science is advancing. We have to keep in touch with science. We got to look at the benefits and risks as we go along and look at the evidence. So I don't pay too much attention to conventional sort of ways of managing, because as the evidence comes in, it changes. So I think we have to go with the flow. But looking at this, it has helped a lot of people who, say, 30 years ago would never have dreamt of having a child. And now many of them have twins and they got a family. But the question still remains is it survival of the fittest? Because many of them, you see, the male sperm count is poor, the quality of the sperms is poor. You can now inject the sperm into an egg, which is not the greatest of quality, mm-hmm. and yet produce an adult. And some of them have fertility problems later in life. So I believe that to a certain point, when you fiddle too much with nature, you are not producing the best quality, which eventually will lead to further genetic issues down the road. Because some of them are actually not very fertile. And they are passing bad genes down. And these are not, as you call it, the survival of the fittest.
Fittest.
Yeah. So that the evidence is still there. We know that there is some association with certain syndromes. It's luckily very, very slight. But I think in the next 30, 40 years, we will know. There's already some early evidence that IVF babies are not strictly normal in that sense that they are more prone to hypertension and some of the other metabolic diseases in relation to others. That's partly because the parents themselves may be diabetic or hypertensive, but partly because the handling of the embryo, and this has been done with animal work and published, even handling the embryo can disturb the environment and create problems later in life. So I come back to my statement, survival of the fittest. Are we producing good qualities which can survive the storm in the future?
Interesting thought. We will keep that in mind. Moving on to whatever the second point you made about expectations have changed. What do you mean by that?
Well, generally, the education level is much better. So people can read. There's computers. They have access to knowledge, which is good. I am actually all for it. But the thing that worries me is a lot of people go onto social websites where people give their personal experience, not evidence-based medicine. is their experience that you do this, it works, you do that, it works, and so on. And that's not evidence-based. So this is hearsay evidence. So that worries me, because some of them have gone into this in a big way, and they believe that so much, and eventually it becomes very difficult to actually explain to them that this is not in their best interest. And along with it has come this big controversy about vaginal birth at all costs, natural childbirth where they don't even go to hospitals and deliver.
Yeah.
Why the husbands delivered at home. There have been a few deaths because of this. And then they leave the baby with a rotting placenta, you know, and let it drop off by itself. And you know, also they eat their own placenta. So I sometimes feel that there's a regression in advancement, where instead of being safer and have a healthy mother and baby, they have actually retrogressed to some extent.
But why do you think we have gone down that path, though? Is it because there has been some amount of abuse in the past, or there's obviously a lack of trust somewhere?
Yes.
What's gone wrong?
I agree with you. There is a lack of trust in doctors. They think that doctors medicalize the situation. To some extent, it's true. I don't disagree with that. And I think it's how you practice that's important. And also, I think part of it is because of lack of proper counseling and description of the benefits versus risks to allow the patient to make an informed decision. I think that's the best way to go about it. If that is not done, then the patient then feels that they are not subject to all the knowledge and all the evidence for them to make a proper decision. And so that has led to dissatisfaction. And part of it is the new trend. The main trend now is vaginal birth at all costs. And just a few days ago, the Royal College of Midwives in the UK has come up with a statement that they are moving away from that, because they have found that it is not well known, but it has been certainly been published over the last at least 5 to 10 years. And there's a lot of good data that a difficult vaginal delivery gives rise to a lot of problems in the pelvic floor at the age of 40. And there were several cases. In fact, I just saw this article from UK where they had a horrific forceps delivery. See, because you leave them for labor for so long, they're unable to push. So they then get a vacuum or a forceps delivery, and they have done horrific injuries, some to the baby, a lot to the mother, and as a result has damaged their whole pelvic floor. And the whole pelvic floor has dropped out, uterus has dropped out, the bladder has dropped down, the incontinence of feces and urine, and the gynecological urologists are having a field day working on them. Mm-hmm. And this has been published, yet people don't pay much attention. So a difficult vaginal delivery or a prolonged vaginal delivery causes much more damage than an elective caesar. And some of the women who have actually been, you know, interviewed in that article say they wish that they hadn't pushed for this, in retrospect. But that will always be the case. On the other hand, I think some people advocate C-section too easily. So I think all this has led to patients being confused. Where do I go? Mm-hmm. Where do I turn to? Who gives me a balanced opinion? You know? So I think that is, in the current era of access to knowledge, had led to this.
You spoke about, you know, wanting to do things the patient's way, I mean, the pregnant woman's way in that. But don't you think that, you know, it is part of the woman's right to, you know, her body and how she wants to go through the whole pregnancy and delivery?
No, I fully agree. But it should be based on the current situation. Not when you are 44, first child, diabetic, hypertensive, with a whole host of medical problems, and you insist with a very unfavorable cervix, high head, that you still want a vaginal delivery, you're putting yourself and the baby at risk. So it becomes meaningless when you put all the various factors together. But if you are a young woman, everything is perfect. You have a good chance of vaginal delivery. By all means, have it well monitored and so on. But this is where, you know, the funny thing is, the women who can actually have vaginal delivery actually refuse. And we have about 5% of them who come and say, no vaginal delivery, section me. And you try and convince them not to have a C-section and they refuse. So what do you say to that? So you are having yourself unnecessary risks of a C-section in spite of advice against not doing a C-section. So you also get that other side of it.
Yes. We'll come back. I want to get your thoughts on how you have evolved in this role as a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist. That's coming through after the break. If you have a question, we have Dr. Raman Subramaniam, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist. It's very hard to get this man in the studio. So if you want to, you give us a call right now. The number is 0377-109000. You can tweet me FM Radio or WhatsApp 0187898899. We'll come back and also find out more about the development of the fetus at every stage in terms of nutrition, in terms of everything else, what is really going on in a mother's womb. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health and Living. Dr. Raman Subramaniam, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, in the studio with me. We are discussing nurturing a healthy pregnancy. Earlier on, we went through how age is a factor, and then we've spoken about expectations. We've spoken about the woman's right in terms of a vaginal delivery and a C-section. And of course, Dr. Raman goes on to say how fertility has dropped, male infertility has dropped in particular. I think I cannot impress upon everyone, every woman, when you spoke about the damaged pelvic floor. We did do a show with Dr. George Lee and a urogynecologist just about 2 weeks ago. Go and listen to that because that's exactly what she talks about. Kegels all the way and do it right. Find out how you're going to do it right. Earlier on, you mentioned all these challenges, Dr. Raman. I just want to know, as somebody who's been in this profession for a very long time, how have you evolved in this role as a consultant obstetrician and gynecologist? Because back in the day, it was much easier. Women just came to you, you told them what to do, and they would do it. That isn't the case anymore.
Absolutely. I think those days, people respected doctors. Doctors were thought to be God. They knew everything. And so patients followed. But nowadays, with access to information, patients are better informed. And sometimes they catch out their doctors who are not that well informed. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm very happy to note that this is a good thing, that their access to information keeps a check on the knowledge of the doctor. The only issue there is whether the doctor keeps up to date. You see, I have evolved purely because of evidence-based medicine. And I believe that everything should be based on evidence. There is publications, scientific evidence, guidelines based on evidence, and that's the way forward. It's also become the way forward medico-legally, because if you are unfortunate enough to land up in court and get grilled by a medico-legal lawyer, this is exactly what they bring up. And then when they ask you questions, and they show you the evidence, and if you have to agree, you are caught. So I think the modern-day doctor has to keep up to date. There are at least 1,000 over articles which are published per day. And based on this Cochrane and other databases, new evidence comes out every 6 months, guidelines come out, and they give you the latest papers. In fact, I was just sent a paper which is going to be published on the 27th. Advanced publication has come out in the New England Journal on the use of aspirin for high-risk pregnancy or like hypertension in pregnancy. It's already come out because the data is good. They want this to be given to patients, and rightly so. So I think the modern-day doctor has to be in touch with current guidelines, evidence, and the state of the art as it is to correctly advise the patients.
Does that mean the insurance you're paying for malpractice is a lot higher? Or is it the highest among obstetrician gynecologists?
Well, I think a few specialties are particularly prone. Neurosurgery, plastic surgery, obstetrics and gynecology, they are the premier ones. And what has recently happened is some of the medical legal indemnity companies have shifted from the fact that they covered you forever to now covering you year by year, and you have to continue even after you stop. You have to pay or come up with a deal that you have done X number of years with that medical legal association, and they will cover you for the rest of your life. You must understand that in the current Malaysian law, a woman for ordinary cases can sue for the government for up to 3 years. That's the time limit. And up to 6 years for private. And when it comes to obstetrics, it goes another 18 years. So you have something like 24, 25 years which you can still take a case against the doctor.
What happens if you've passed on?
Even if you have passed on, they can sue your estate.
They can do it.
I actually have been to a case, two cases I know of, and one I was involved in where they sued the estate of the doctor who had passed away. And it's so it doesn't end there. So I think it's getting trickier, partly expectations, partly when there's an adverse event. The first question is, why did it happen? And then when somebody gives you, this was what should have been done, or this was not advised, and the next thing, two things happen. One, they actually report to the Malayan Medical Council and they have an inquiry, or they take a medical legal suit, and that leads to a lot of doctors have actually given up obstetrics because of this.
I was just going to ask you, do you think this will be a deterrent for younger doctors to actually go into this field?
It is. In fact, in many years ago in Australia, this happened and the whole system collapsed in Australia. So nowadays, and it's slowly rising, private obstetrics in Australia. But at some point, nobody wanted to do obstetrics. It's all government. So unless there is some capping of, indemnity payments based on awards, and awards are rising. The awards are rising. So it's difficult.
Okay. We have a question here via WhatsApp. Hi, doctor. I'm a 30-year-old single female. I've just learned that I have a mild lumbar scoliosis. I'm planning to have a family in the next 2 to 3 years. What is your opinion, and would it be risky to get pregnant? And this is coming from Aisha.
Hi, Aisha. Thank you for the question. It's not uncommon in women to have scoliosis. It's actually, not uncommon at all. I've had several patients. They don't have any problems with fertility at all. Because you have lumbar scoliosis, the only factor that you need to consider is when you're in labor, you need to find a good anesthetist who can do an epidural for you. As I see it, that may be your major hurdle. But there are alternatives as well besides an epidural. You can have injections or gas. But other than that, you shouldn't have a problem if there are no other medical associated problems.
Okay. If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 03-7710-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Now let's look at the fetus development, Dr. Raman, and the role of the woman in the development of this fetus. How would you describe this process? Because in the first 8 weeks, for an example, what happens during the pregnancy? Which window is most important? So on and so forth. Let's start with the first 8 weeks of pregnancy.
Yes, I think the first 3 months is the first trimester. And then, of course, you have when an embryo becomes a fetus, which is 8 weeks of fetal age and 10 weeks of menstrual age. During that first, 10 to 12 weeks is when the development of the organs are. And that's very, very critical because it's this early stage development where they're exposed to drugs or environment or viruses which can severely damage the baby. Of course, genetic conditions are inherent, which you have no control over. But the environmental issues can actually cause severe problems like lack of folic acid and the baby born without a brain or part of the brain missing, heart defects, with viruses, certain viruses like rubella and so on. So a lot of these conditions make the fetus susceptible in the first 3 months, particularly the first 8 to 10 weeks. So that part is extremely important. There's also the part where the women are nauseous and they can't eat well. Many of them are worried that they are not taking enough food. Actually, they don't need to worry as long as they hydrate themselves. The main problem is when you vomit a lot and you can't even drink water, you break down fat and cause acid accumulation, and that's not good. Mm-hmm. So, and you lose a lot of weight. Then you need to be admitted and given drugs, stop the vomiting, hydration, and so on. So I tell patients, if they can, just hydrate yourself, take sweet drinks. You don't really need to load yourself with food. Make sure you take your folic acid and multivitamins, particularly the B-complex, and that's enough. You don't have to eat tons of food and eat for two. Not at that stage. Most women tend to lose weight in the first trimester to some extent, but hydration is important.
Okay. What about the second trimester?
The second trimester is usually the best honeymoon period. Patients begin to feel well. They actually have less vomiting. They have a sense of well-being. And when they start feeling the baby move inside them, they get a lot of excitement, a lot of bonding. And they're generally the happiest at that time. The fetus grows at a very rapid stage at this stage, right up to about 32 weeks. The growth is almost linear. And when they have the doctors scan them, they can actually see the development of the baby, the formation of the face and all the organs. They can see skin developing, so they start getting, nice puffy cheeks and so on. As that develops, and you can sometimes even see hair development at the end of the second trimester in the fetus. So a lot of things are developed by the first trimester. You can see fingers, you can see the toes, you can see a lot of things. And nowadays with advanced imaging, you can even look at the major organs like heart and stomach, and you can even do by 13, 14 weeks a major analysis of major structural abnormalities as well,
wow,
besides the genetic abnormalities.
Okay.
So these are the advances that are coming in at the moment.
When is a woman considered malnourished during pregnancy?
The word malnourished is a tricky question. I mean, how do you define it? I think is the requirements for a pregnant woman are around 2,200 to 2,500 calories, depending on her weight. If she is less than 45 kilos, she needs to gain about 16 to 17 kilos throughout pregnancy to have a healthy fetus. If you're 100 kilos, we allow 7 to 8 kilos gain
wow.
of weight.
Okay.
So if you look at this, it is proportionate to body size. So that's where the problem is. So if a woman is 100 kilos and gains 12 to 15 kilos, this baby is huge and she's going to have problems.
So when do you know that a woman's not consuming enough? Baby's growing well, but we don't know the effects of not being nutritionally sufficient till much later on, isn't it, Dr. Raman? I mean, you know of studies that show that mothers who don't eat properly produce smaller babies, while fathers who are not nourished properly have offspring who are smaller by the time they're 2 years old. So how would we know the effects? And we won't know till much later.
No, there's a lot of good data on the Dutch Hunger Winter Study. I don't know whether you've heard of it.
Not heard.
Okay, this is a very famous study where the Germans, the Nazis, blockaded Holland in 1944 for 6 months because there was some difference of opinion because of the resistance against the Germans. The Germans actually walked into Holland. And the 2,000 over calories that is required for a pregnant woman dropped to 500 calories. People were literally eating bits and insects and whatever scraps of food they could get. And there's beautiful data, even up to 60 years from the effects of famine on those. Only those who are in their first trimester and in the early second trimester who were malnourished had any effect on the fetus. But those who were in the last trimester, there was no effect at all. But those with the early trimester, they actually delivered small babies. And these babies now have delivered babies which are still small. So that through the epigenetics pathway, in one generation, it has produced an adverse effect, which has gone on now for two generations, we have data. So there is actually very good data on the critical periods of growth and the effect of malnourishment at which stage. So the first 16 weeks is when there is excessive division of cells, and that is critical for the ultimate size of the baby. After that, beyond about 26, 28 weeks, it's just the same cell growing fatter in size. So babies which are affected in the later part of pregnancy, they are leaner, but eventually when they come out, they grow tall and grow big. But those that are damaged by, say, viruses or other metabolic disease or whatever, in the early first trimester will remain small forever.
Okay.
And they will produce genetically small babies more likely.
So how does that explain us now? I do understand that women now are delivering bigger babies.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, first of all, it's because nutrition has changed and also junk food has increased. So it's not the fact that they are not eating a lot, but they're eating the wrong kinds of food. They should take a very good balanced diet. They should eat, you know, 50% of their diet should be carbohydrate. Then there should be about 20% of protein and 30% of fat. There are some people who believe high protein is good. Actually, if you eat a lot of high protein without carbohydrate, the babies are small because they can't be converted into energy because the fetus relies purely on carbohydrate for brain and muscle and body development. You need that. So if you restrict carbohydrate intake, you're going to produce a small baby. And when you change these people's diet, you see the baby growing bigger. So there is some manipulation they can do. So diet, eating enough fruits, vegetables, meat, and other things are important. And a well-balanced diet is available on the internet. There are a lot of associations that give you ideal diets for pregnancy.
And the fact that we're having bigger babies, doesn't that affect the delivery process as well?
It does. It was some years ago.
And that poor pelvic floor that you're talking about.
It does. At one stage, if you look at the Orang Asli, when I used to see them in the 70s, they were short, right? And the babies were only hardly 2 kilos. And that was enough for the pelvis. Then suddenly, their nutrition improved and the babies became bigger. They got stuck. And then they landed up with a lot of problems and needed C-section and ruptured uterus, all sorts of complications. Now the next generation has grown taller and bigger, and they can take up bigger babies. Now you look at a Scandinavian woman whose average height is almost 6 foot. A 4.2 kilo will drop out very easily, right? But an Asian Japanese woman, by the way, has increased in Second World War the height because of better nutrition. They probably have trouble with the 3.5, 3.6 kilo because they're slim and shorter. There is some relationship, but not absolute. I've seen women who are only 5 foot 2 deliver a 4.2 kilo easily. And I've seen tall women who are 5 foot 10 have difficulties with a 3.4 kilo. Mm-hmm. So it's relative, but not absolute.
Okay. We are discussing nurturing a healthy pregnancy. Dr. Raman Subramaniam in the studio with us, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist. We'll be back after a quick market update on what's happening in Bursa, Malaysia. Meanwhile, if you have a question, give us a call, 03-77-109-1000, tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 if you have a question, and I'm sure he'll be happy to answer that. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment, Dr. Raman Subramaniam, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist, we're discussing nurturing a healthy pregnancy. Dr. Raman, of course, looks very much at high-risk pregnancies now. I'm sure you see the worst of the worst, Dr. Raman. And doesn't that scare you and put you into, like, you know, very paranoid kind of a mode when you deal with your patients?
You're talking about defensive medicine.
Yes.
I think that's true. To some extent, that's true. But at the same time, it's also very challenging because, you know, most of the pregnancies in most women, 90% is normal. But now we are seeing this group of women with high risk. And you need to have a multidisciplinary understanding of the subject. You have to have a team. And I have a team with me, an anesthetist whom I like, who specializes in obstetrics anesthesia, neonatologists, physicians, subspecialists, and we join together to manage the patient. So I think the management of high-risk pregnancies involves a good team, and that leads to a success story.
And what is the underlying theme as to why you see more and more high-risk pregnancies?
I think there has always been high-risk pregnancies, but sometimes there was not enough medical treatment available in the past. There's much more advances in medical treatment. The other thing is imaging has improved and we are picking up abnormalities earlier. Genetics has improved, so our ability to do genetic testing early and very advanced has also improved. So there are a lot of general factors which have led to the ability to diagnose. Firstly, to diagnose. Secondly, advances in surgical skills and ability to treat the fetus and so on in the womb. All these advances has made this an approach. Say, 30, 40 years ago, you just tell the patient, I'm so sorry, nothing is available, that's it. But now, no. You could offer options or at least provide them with a place where you could send them to attempt to try and save the baby. And I think that has led to our current state, that there are much more, it is much more availability of facilities for diagnosis and treatment.
We have a question here from Yahya bin Zakaria. I love this question. What's your professional opinion about confinement and the pantang post-labor? Is there any medical basis to it, especially on the dietary intake?
That is a very interesting question. Because when you talk about the confinement practices, it varies between the races.
Yes.
Between the Malay, the Chinese, and the Indians. If you look at scientific evidence, some of the practices, in my opinion, is harmful. And as you know, especially for the Chinese, my Chinese patients, I strictly tell them no dong quai and pao sum and ginseng, which act like an aspirin, and they bleed like crazy, even during pregnancy or delivery or after delivery. Some of them are actually in the WHO list of poisons, but they are used because they believe that they bleed, they cleanse the body and all that, but actually they are harmful. And many of these practices that they've done has not been researched enough.
But don't you think there has to be some basis to it if it's been practiced for years?
The trouble is there is no, the limited evidence on scientific research that's been done, many of them in practice have shown to be of no value. See, there are a lot of things like, for example, you bleed or you must rest in bed, you know, if you have a bit of bleeding or if you have early pregnancy, mustn't walk, mustn't have sex and all that. That's all been shown to be not true in proper scientific evidence-based medicine. So many of the beliefs of the parents, oh, you mustn't use aircon, the child will get asthma, that's not true. So there's so much of hearsay, but little scientific evidence. I grant it that some of them may be beneficial, but we haven't had proper research done in that area. So I'm unable to comment on all of them, but I can tell you quite a lot of the practices, in my opinion, are not found to be scientifically viable. So I will stop there because it will lead to a lot of controversy from the older women who will probably come and complain to me when they come with their children.
It will. And, you know, our grandmothers turning in their graves because of this. You know, another question here. What is the oldest age a woman should consider pregnancy?
That's interesting because if you look at the literature, I think the oldest woman recently in India was 72.
But that was through IVF.
All through IVF. Mm-hmm. But natural conceptions, I think the oldest is in the 50s, 52 or 53. So it's the youngest, just below 6 years. As in Peru, I think. There was a girl who got pregnant at that age and delivered the baby by C-section. So I think to be safe, I think once you hit the 40s, your chances of a viable live birth actually drops, particularly after 45.
Okay. So from what I'm hearing from you, 22 to 25 is really the best age. Push it up to 33, perhaps.
35 would be good.
Okay.
And then after 40s, and particularly after 45, it goes downhill.
Okay. Let's talk about overnutrition. I think that's something we struggle with even here in Malaysia. A lot of us here are overweight or obese. How is that translating when it comes to the pregnancies?
Oh, overweight women are particularly high-risk group. They're actually undernourished, a lot of them. They have micronutrient deficiencies. So you actually look big, but actually they are deficient in a lot of vitamins and minerals, which can have adverse effect on pregnancy. They are more prone to hypertension and diabetes, and that adversely affects the fetus. They also tend to produce bigger babies, higher risk of stillbirth, and they tend to have poorer labors, higher risks of C-section. And even if they do C-section, they tend to bleed more and end up having horrific problems because the uterus won't contract because it's infiltrated with fat.
I don't understand. How does the baby become malnourished if the mother is overweight?
Because when they are bigger, all the fat-soluble vitamins are in the fat, not in the body. And so they actually suffer from deficiencies of the ADEK, the fat-soluble vitamins, which are very important also for the fetus, particularly vitamin D.
The vitamins, okay.
Very important. And folic acid and all these important nutrients for the baby. Actually, you need higher amounts according to body weight. So 400 micrograms is the minimum for an average-sized woman. You need 600 to 800 micrograms for an obese woman to maintain this. So they are therefore more prone to abnormal babies, particularly brain, spinal cord, heart abnormalities, higher in obese women. Right? And when you add diabetes and hypertension, particularly diabetes, that leads to a lot of other problems.
And is
big
that,
babies.
Yes. And is that why you see a lot of high-risk pregnancies as well now?
Yes. Because we are now in Southeast Asia, the obesity capital.
We are. Nothing to be proud about, but we are indeed. Polluted environments, how much does that play a role in pregnancy?
It depends. When you say pollution, is it water pollution, air pollution?
Everything, really.
Everything. Definitely, it would play a role, particularly air pollution, leads to a lot of asthma, which is part of the non-communicable diseases, and that can have adverse effect on the baby. Water pollution, unless it is with all sorts of drugs and hormones, and there has been some data, not that much in Malaysia, where they have shown that a lot of human, like estrogen and progesterone and male hormones in the water has changed the sex of fishes and may contribute to some extent to male infertility as well. So we don't have much huge data, but we know that pollution does play a role. Atmospheric pollution is the best studied. Water pollution, less studied. And definitely it will have a role to play, okay. Particularly with non-communicable diseases.
Sure. Diabetes, I think, is a big problem in Malaysia.
With obesity, there is, yes.
Yes. And how does diabetes affect a pregnancy?
Well, if the diabetes is not well controlled, it can lead to severe abnormalities in the baby in the first trimester. But in the later part of pregnancy, if it's not well controlled, the excessive glucose causes big babies, which actually leads to stillbirth.
That's how harsh it is.
It is.
Okay. We have a question here. How much nutrition should mother be concerned about when it comes to pregnancy? For example, vitamin D and folic acid. As you said, birth weight. Is there a formula to calculate this?
For birth weight of the baby?
The weight of the mother and the nutrition that's required. Because you did say vitamin D varies, the folic acid dosage varies when mother actually takes the folic acid.
Yes.
Is there a formula to calculate that?
No, the average size, which is up to about, say, 65 to 70 kilos, 400 micrograms per day is enough. But when you go beyond that, then I would go to 600. And you go beyond 100 kilos, I would use 800 microgram. Most of the tablets here come in 1 milligram or 5 milligram. So more than enough.
Okay.
And they are not toxic in the sense they are excreted in the urine. But vitamin D is very deficient. And even the CNAT study and local data, and I've been involved with some of this work, we are highly deficient in vitamin D. If vitamin D is very low, it is also a cause of infertility.
Of course. And
implantation problems.
And it just doesn't make sense living in this country to be vitamin D deficient.
That's true. That's true. But unfortunately, it's the way you are covered. You don't like to go in the sun. It's between 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon is when your maximum amount of vitamin D is produced. If you are darker in nature, then your vitamin D is very little produced, even you are in the sun for half an hour.
Okay, all right. Something to bear in mind. Last question. A question from a listener. When you mentioned 40 and then 45 downhill, does it refer to your first pregnancy?
I think it refers to all pregnancies. But if your first pregnancy at 45 is much worse than is your third pregnancy at 45, because at 45, even if it's your third pregnancy, it depends on the interval between babies. Anything more than 6 years carries a higher risk, interpregnancy interval. And the main thing is association of diabetes and hypertension. And there may be other diseases as well.
Your message?
Eat healthy, maintain a good weight, exercise in pregnancy, and be as cool as possible. So rest your brain. Don't think too much. Go with the flow.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Dr. Raman Subramaniam, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist on nurturing a healthy pregnancy on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.